Okay, so this is Connor, one of the producers for Open Source.
And I'm Max, I'm another one of the producers.
And we're checking in on our fundraising campaign. And big news, right?
1/6
Sixth
of the way.
We're nearly there.
Well, 1/6 of the way there. Not nearly, but we're 1/6 of the way there. And it's very exciting. And we're extremely thankful to the people who made it happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much, but it does take some support from listeners like you.
Definitely.
Come visit us on patreon.com/radioopensource and give just a little bit each month. It means the world to us. It helps this conversation run week after week, and we try to make it interesting. We try to make it for you.
Mm-hmm. We love doing this work, and we need your help. And so again, it's patreon.com/radioopensource.
That's patreon.com/radioopensource.
Okay, so that's it. On with the show.
On with the show.
Let's do it.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. At halftime in 2016, the game is coming clear on the playing field, and still it's a mystery in our heads. So this hour is Hearts and Minds time. At a break. Who'll say what we're going through? What brought us to this boiling point? Part of the gaudy, god-awful strangeness this year, rancor and rage at the core of self-government, is that it can feel so familiar, as if we felt it before. And in 1968 and 72, we did. Young Hillary Rodham and boyfriend Bill Clinton were on the insurgent team in 72 with the lefty peacenik George McGovern, the Bernie Sanders of his day. She's now the power they were fighting then. So there's a certain dizziness on this merry-go-round and some disbelief. Who would you trust to say what got into us this past year and whether we'll ever get it out? We ask not pundits, not Pauls, but first the beloved prize novelist of the Middle West, Marilyn Robinson. And then the psychologist and master journalist of surprises, Andrew Solomon, and the philosopher of democracy and everyday life in America, Nancy Rosenblum. The assignment is to pin the tail on our discontent, as many tails and discontents as you care to imagine. Transfiguration is the Christian word that clings to Marilyn Robinson because her novels like Housekeeping 35 years ago and Gilead and her religious and other essays make readers feel a radiant divinity in people. I asked her this week how she explains with her friends this sound of 2016, what she calls a scream.
We really don't know what's going on in the country, and I think it's valuable to find out that we don't know what's going on in the country.
Mm.
I think it's certainly true that the way that the new economy is talked about and the way that it is emerging, it is as if it will simply abandon a large part of the population to what? Mm. God knows, you know. I mean, there are limits to how long you can sell each other hamburgers. I think that there's a very real fear on the part of people whose family history and culture and so on is rooted in traditional manufacture or whatever. We should not be prioritizing our economy over our population. Mm. We should not be passive in relation to the brutal consequences of economic evolutions. I think one of the worst things that's happened in modern American history is that we have started talking about ourselves as a capitalism rather than as a democracy. Hmm. And if we're a capitalism, then, you know, the great machine rolls on, you know. If we're a democracy, we are advised by the needs and wishes of the population in general.
How well do you remember 1964, but especially 68 and 72? The Vietnam War conventions, but also the feeling of a broken conversation, of tremendous youth alienation.
I remember it very well. It was a sort of a central part of my earlier life. And I remember Eugene McCarthy saying, you know, I'm proud to address the nation in exile, or whatever he called it, systematically leading his youth following away from the Democratic Party. I think that Hubert Humphrey would have been an infinitely better president than Richard Nixon. We've seen this over and over again. Everybody talks about Al Gore and Ralph Nader and so on. But that was an earlier instance that I think was catastrophically significant. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Bernie Sanders. I'm very happy with Hillary Clinton. I certainly hope that we don't sabotage the system again by leading the natural constituents of a liberal Democrat away from her when the chips are down.
We wonder about that, the tragedy of Hubert Humphrey. I got to know him later. He was an adorable man and a first-class public spirit.
Absolutely.
I remember him saying, "The word efficiency is not in the Bible." And society can be measured by how it treats people in the dawn of life, that's children, and in the shadows of life, that's the handicapped, and in the twilight of life, that's elders. Jesse Jackson stole it from him and made it a better line in a way. But Hubert's heart was so fine, and yet the tragedy was so complete around Vietnam.
True, absolutely. But what, Nixon said he had a secret plan or something like that? Good grief.
But Hubert had dirty hands, too.
So do we all. You know, looking for moral perfection in a national politician is probably not useful. You have to take things in broader generalities than that. There are people who love the country, which means everybody in it. And there are people who have a kind of an ideological sense of what it ought to be, although it never was. And they are willing to virtually attack portions of the population because they stand between the realization of this ideology and the present time. You know, we have people who one way or another, you know, are not contributors or whatever. God bless them. It's just humankind, you know. If you love a country, you love its people in the twilight and people in the dawn, you know. I just can't understand that. It's a sort of holier than thou, more righteous than thou, higher income than thou sort of stance that just appalls me.
But when you think of those 60s crises and the glorious people through it, on the whole, are you consoled that we got through it or kind of alarmed that it kept ending badly?
I think that the Vietnam War was a catastrophe in many ways, one of them being, I think, an unarticulated anxiety among parts of the population that we tend not to win wars, that we involve ourselves in a war, we throw $1 trillion into the war, we maim a generation of our people. And then at the end of it, we say, well, that wasn't really about anything. Why don't we leave? Which we do, thank God. But at the same time, this pattern of involving ourselves in a war that we don't, you know, that we get tired of, in effect, rather than saying at the beginning, this would not be a good idea. This has been going on since Korea. What the wiser heads conclude is that we really ought not to do anything stupid, that is, involve ourselves in a conflict we can avoid. But there are other people, I think, who want to fight a war that we can win. And I think that George Bush was appealing to that impulse, you know. And it's going to drag us into one war after another after another. We have to finally say, we have to disavow this. We're not going to invade anybody. It never ends well. We should know by now.
I know what you mean. I can look back on the last 30, 40, 50 years going back to Vietnam as a very melancholy time at home and worse than that, abroad. I guess my best question for you, Marilynne Robinson, is how does your America start again and pick up the pieces and go on? Wiser, if possible, but with a kind of American grit.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is true of this country is if we just let it find its own nature, prosper by its own lights, if we gave people what they wanted, for example, education, which is increasingly difficult for many people to have access to and so on, if we respected the country, responded to its needs, responded to its objectives, I think we'd have a good, solid country. If you want a democracy, what you have to say is, we respect the self-determination of people, that this is assisted by health systems, educational systems, and so on that make them able to live their lives fully. Obviously, I'm devoted to a certain moral system. I assume that many other people in many other ways are devoted to moral systems, and that if you let them live out their lives without fear of their, you know, being able to look after their children properly and so on, that they would lead good lives and that the country would flourish. I am not a missionary for a restoration of values or something. I just want, you know, a better politics that doesn't stand in the way of things that are obviously necessary. I want a higher estimation of what people are so that more would be in school and fewer would be in prison.
There's an interesting conversation out there about whether American people brought all this unhappiness on themselves, that they're not quite up to democracy, and that the Trump vote proves it with their individual problems, their family neglect, their loss of faith or whatever. It's time to move on, but they're not the future.
I don't know what the Trump vote means, and I don't think any of us will really know until November. I think it's kind of a loud scream more than anything else, and that it can be interpreted in lots of different ways. But it's a phenomenon of the primaries, which, you know, people can vote for him without electing him. I will wait and see how things sort themselves out ultimately. But using Trump categories, you know, like losers are people who vote for Trump, if that's coming from the left, is just as mean-spirited as when he talks about losers coming from the right, you know. I cannot dismiss what is, after all, a democratic phenomenon, which is a disturbing and uninterpretable vote that has to be taken on seriously and cannot be dismissed with talk about people losing their values or something.
I'm with you. I don't think we can run a democracy blaming the people, and that a scream, even in primaries, has to be heard and taken seriously. I mean, parse it if you possibly can. Take that mysterious, agonized scream apart.
But I do think that people have been put in a double bind. We don't accept the humanity of their lives in the sense that people say, well, if these towns are dying, they should just pack up and move on, you know?
Somebody said, it's U-Haul time. That's what we
get
to send them.
Yes, exactly. If you had a decent human respect for these people, you would know that you're asking them to leave the place where their parents are buried, the place where they have every close relationship that they've ever had in their lives, the place that they love because that's where they go hunting in the woods and so on, you know? It would be bizarre and infuriating to have somebody come along and say, you know, you're not economically viable, pack up. I mean, it's just bizarre. This is a country, a human country with people in it.
We spoke with Marilynne Robinson by phone in her Chicago hotel room this week. She is the writer that President Obama sought out for public conversations about the heart of the country last year. She's just retired from the University of Iowa and its famous writer's workshop. The novel Leela is her most recent book, doubtless not her last. Coming up, we're asking the psychologist and author, Andrew Solomon, to compare a nation in turmoil with a person in pain. He's the doctor I'd want to be asking the patient, where does it hurt? This is Open Source. Andrew Solomon is a clinical psychologist, a discoverer in science and in endless travels, and he writes elegantly about what he finds. Your masterwork, if I may be so bold, Andrew, is a thick book called Far From the Tree, about children who grow up shockingly unlike their parents. Some of them geniuses, some of them criminals, unaccountable prodigies, maybe in composing operas, maybe in ice hockey. Imagine this great republic in 2016, Andrew, if you will, as a patient, and share all the notes you can compile about it. Welcome.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here. I would begin by diagnosing an enormous amount of fear, an enormous amount of anxiety, which is one of the ways that fear bubbles up to the surface, and an enormous amount of anger. And Freud famously said that depression is anger turned inward. So there's a lot of anger turned outward at the moment, but I think that along with that, there's quite a lot of anger turned inward and a lot of depression. But I think the body politic, or the body of the country, is really at the moment blinded by these very extreme and very primal emotions, and that the ability of people to act on the basis of logical thought rather than on the basis of painful emotion is very much compromised at this point.
What do we mean by primal? Is this about mother and dad? Is it about the economy? Is it about their own kids? Is it about, you know, robots in the job market? Is it about...
Well, it's about all of those things. It's about the fear of being abandoned or displaced, which are the real root of most primal human emotions. It's the sense on the part of the much quoted angry white male voters who are all running after Donald Trump. It's the sense that they used to be the kind of people who run the world and they no longer are. Now, that's kind of a misapprehension because a lot of those voters were never the kind of people who ran the world. All they have in common with Donald Trump is that they're white males. But they still somehow think that he represents their interests, even though they are so demographically far apart. So there's that. And there is there's an explosion of a kind of rage at the understanding that the world is changing around them and that with globalism, it is not automatically the case that Americans will rule the rest of the world, and it is not automatically the case that that white people will rule America, and it is not necessarily the case that men will be in charge of what happens to women and all of these other power structures. The changes in which in many ways represent enormous social progress are extremely threatening to the people who benefited from a previous system. And the irony is that a lot of the rhetoric of the election is around taking back from the 1% who are privileged and who by and large fit that demographic. The people who are fighting against the 1% are in affiliating themselves with Donald Trump, actually associating themselves with the less than 1%, with a kind of crass elitism, which is, you know, neither serving their interests as individuals nor serving their interests as a social grouping.
Andrew Solomon, stick with that word abandonment, just because Marilynne Robinson used it too, as if the economy is just abandoning workers. I mean, we're familiar with that general notion of, you know, an abandonment syndrome or anxiety, but...
Well, look, there's a wonderful description of the way that a changing society abandons its workers in Death of a Salesman. A wonderfully poignant description of Willie Loman, who worked for the company for all those years, and then he comes in and he's losing his job and he's being pushed aside, and he says, but look what I've done and look at the years of my life that I gave you. And they basically try to be polite and nice to him, but they just don't need it anymore and they can't be bothered. And poor Willie Loman is left abandoned and in a state of acute despair. And I think an enormous number of Americans grew up believing that there were certain kinds of jobs that were an eternal part of an unchangeable economy, that manufacturing jobs would continue to exist, that all kinds of administrative jobs would continue to exist. And a lot of the unskilled labor is now either going abroad or being turned over, as you put it, to robots. It's being mechanized out of existence. I think people grew up with a sense that you grow up in a community and have an affiliation with it in order to find work. Marilynne Robinson talked about the trauma of having to leave the place where your parents are buried. More and more people leave the place not only where their parents are buried, but where their parents are living. Families are scattered. The cohesion that used to come with a sense of place is being destroyed and undermined, and people are alone. I mean, there was a wonderful campaign that was done by a group working on the issue of rising rates of suicide that showed a picture of someone sitting in front of a computer and it said 5,000 Facebook friends and no one to talk to. And I think people feel they've been abandoned by their community. They've been abandoned by their work. They have had to abandon or separate themselves from their family. And while they may have lives that look busy from the outside, the level of aloneness that has become commonplace in America is of a different nature than anything that's come before.
We also learned from Arthur Miller in Death of a Salesman that attention must be paid. That's what I remember from that play. This is serious. It's a public concern. But go back to her wonderful line about unarticulated anxieties. Play the doctor again, Andrew. I mean, what do you notice about this patient? Where is he twitching? What is he repeating or doing that tells you what he hasn't told you yet?
Well, I think the anxieties are fairly straightforward. They are, as I said, the anxieties about the loss of power, the loss of cohesion, and the loss of companionship. I mean, those are the anxieties. What I think is bizarre is what people mistake for solutions to those problems. So I can say that I'm a registered Democrat and that I didn't want George W. Bush or Mitt Romney to win the presidency, but I understood why other people wanted George W. Bush or Mitt Romney to win the presidency. I look at Donald Trump, and I think even if you share every one of his bigoted, narrow-minded, cruel opinions and points of view, it seems to me very difficult to look at him in operation and think, that man is primarily concerned with my interests, because Donald Trump, more transparently than any other politician I've encountered, is clearly focused on the interests of one person, and that one person is Donald Trump. So the anxiety, I think, is not so surprising. I think there are lots of reasons for it. I've listed some. Marilyn listed some. There are many more that we could go on about for the next hour. What I think is strange is the solution people perceive to those fears and anxieties, because it's an inauthentic solution.
Andrew, let me introduce Nancy Rosenblum, the political philosopher who's been head of Harvard's government department. Her new treatise is Good Neighbors, a study of the democracy of everyday life. Nancy, you're our neighborhood noticer. You say neighborhoods are the bedrock of public life. Our happy or hostile relationships, you say, with the people living downstairs or next door, tell us who we really are. Spell that out. And what do you see around your neighborhood?
Well, Marilyn Robinson, or so you described it, talks about the divinity that we find in people. And I think we can find the democracy in the American people when we look at everyday life. When we look at political institutions in particular, democracy may be hard to find. It may not even be there, and we can talk about that perhaps. But when you look at everyday relations outside of these institutions, and I think neighbors are the most uninstitutionalized example of that, you see really democratic dispositions and practices all the time, by which I mean a kind of reciprocity and a rough equality of give and take, a willingness to speak out against bullies and other people who speak out personally and also collectively against other people who make trouble, a tolerance of people who want to mind their own business, and a kind of disregard for all of the differences amongst us of status or citizen status or race or class or ethnicity that enter politics, but that we try to disregard amongst neighbors because we treat one another, or should, and mostly do, as decent folk. That is, we're aware of our mutual vulnerability. And what's interesting is that I think that this bedrock of democracy in our dispositions and practices outside of institutions doesn't make its way into democratic politics. And to some extent, you can say that that's, of course, true, that democratic politics is about divisions of interest. They're going to be messy. They're about distributions. They're about more or less power. There's all kinds of conflict and ideology. So we're not going to have the sort of mutuality and reciprocity that comes more or less naturally in America amongst neighbors. But there are more things, I think, interfering with the democracy of democracy than just that.
Andrew, you live in neighborhoods too, but Nancy, stick with the notion that you can tell looking around something. What specifically, where do you see it?
Well, I see it as
the distress, that is,
in the normal relationships of neighbors.
I mean, the change and the ugliness that we're seeing nationally.
Oh, the change in democratic politics.
No, I'm looking for matters of
you know, retail mood. And I have to say, I live in a city of neighborhoods and well off, but I'm at home everywhere. I look around the world and I wonder, wait a sec, how can a country be so unhappy with places like this thriving town, you know, rather not untypical?
Well, I think that people are unhappy for many of the reasons that your other guests described.
I do, too. I think the country's unhappy, but
a situation of, let me put it in two ways, a situation, first of all, of anxiety.
Yep.
Anxiety for the reasons that have been described, but I would put it a little differently than either primal passion or abandonment or even the more concrete things that have been described. But a phrase I would use is that the supply chain of our lives has become opaque to us. We can't understand it. It's out of control. And we don't see solutions to it. So that when bad things happen, recessions or our retirement savings go, or we lose our houses, or we lose our jobs, or it's very clear that people aren't paying attention to the necessities of raising a family, it creates a really very profound anxiety. And I think for me, the best example of this out there today is the example of climate change.
Interesting.
People know
Go ahead.
What is happening around them. They know that this is potentially
True.
Catastrophic. Many Americans experience it, floods and fires and sea rise and the increase in their insurance policies. But the problem is just too big. And they have no confidence that the people who are supposed to be in charge know how to fix it, or that the fixes that are on the table are ones that aren't going to sacrifice them in miserable ways. So I think that the malaise that we see really has to do with this opaqueness and the feeling that the problems are too big and out of our...
I was just going to ask you, Nancy, is it your theory that the bad national mood trickles up from the neighborhoods or down from the job market or the media, or the climate matter, or spiritual life, or entertainment, or you name it. But I take it you think it's coming down local life.
You could call it down, up and down. Yes, it's coming down to them because these are things that are happening to people that are out of their control. They're alien forces. Sometimes, you know, people attribute these problems to alien groups, but these are forces that they cannot understand and they cannot see how they're working. So in that sense, it's trickle down, but it's mainly just from the outside to the inside. And I do think that life around home, and it can be miserable, of course, for a variety of reasons, but the life around home and in the neighborhoods is, relatively speaking, a sphere of, as I say, egalitarian, reciprocal relations. And even when they're violent neighborhoods, you have a sense of shared vulnerability that brings people together in certain ways. So I think it's the bedrock, the sort of saving remnant of what I would describe as democratic practices and dispositions where politics is
Andrew
not.
Solomon, I'm wondering, what do you see on the street, your own neighborhood or others?
Well, one of the things that I see is that many people are in fact able to be sympathetic with their neighbors, but are unable to universalize from that perception of other people's humanity to understanding the humanity of the population as a whole. So I note that even in the voting polls that we're all seeing now, there are white voters and there are black voters. There are high-income voters and low-income voters. There are voters in the middle parts of America. There are coastal voters, and there are many much finer distinctions that are being made. I think that the xenophobia that's reached its kind of apogee in Donald Trump's suggestion that he's going to build a wall against the Mexicans and that he's going to ban Muslims from coming into the country actually plays out at a sort of less exalted level all the time within our own society. That people, even those who have developed that sense of affection for and connection to the people in the house next door, don't know how to extend it to a larger community and feel that whatever it is that lies outside of their immediate domain represents a threat to themselves and to the people who live beside them.
Let me say, I'm not going to defend Donald Trump on anything, but I see him much more as a symptom than as a cause. A lot of these problems existed somewhere in the landscape, in the water, before we focused on him. Where is that xenophobia coming from, again, from the bottom up, Andrew?
Well, I agree that Donald Trump is a symptom rather than a cause. I think he's a symptom, though, that warrants some attention if
yes.
we understand how we've gotten to the point that we're at. I think that there are a great many people who have found a sort of curious mixture of the society equalizing, as I said, a certain amount of geographic displacement, and a sense that the old order is somehow disappearing, that that's generated a lot of that anxiety, and that when people are under threat, they narrow their scope of identification. Hmm. So if you're feeling easy and confident, you can feel easy and confident and think you have a great deal in common with people in, I don't know, Senegal and with astronauts and mathematicians and people who are in all kinds of other fields than the ones that you're in. When you feel under threat, you withdraw into your own limited identity group. And I think identity politics, as it's been defined on the left, though I think it's achieved enormous amounts, and I've written a lot about identity politics, it's very full of praise. I feel like the sort of the movement toward an identity politics has also left people feeling that they need to factionalize, and that factionalizing is undermining process.
If I could amplify this about you may have good relations if you're a good neighbor, but you can't universalize it. And I would say something even more specific than that. That is, that we've lost the intermediate associations. This is well known, the come between our personal relationships and family and so on and so forth, and the wider public world of politics. That is, people no longer join unions. They're not, much less members of voluntary associations. They may be partisans, but most people, of course, don't vote. And so there really is a kind of breakdown of the intermediate structures that brought us from private life and what I call the democracy of everyday life into democracy itself.
Andrew, you're a special case in your travels, and we're going to get to that in the next segment. Your new book, which I love, called Far and Away, chronicles 25 years of travels on 7 continents. You feel obviously very, very comfortable as an American abroad. But I want to know what the esteem of the world in general has to do with our sense of our own personal worth. Give us a headline and we'll come back to it after the break.
Well, the esteem of the world in general is very liberating. It gives us a sense of security in our relative hegemony. And I think when we begin to feel that the rest of the world wants to destroy us, which was a revelation when it came along at 9/11 that that might be the case, when we begin to get into that sense that the world might be full of our enemies, we cut ourselves off from the rest of the world, which is not only ungracious, but also ultimately incredibly dangerous because...
Hold it there. Coming up with Andrew Solomon and Nancy Rosenblum, a little more of that sense of deja vu all over again in the distress of our democracy in 2016. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. At halftime in 2016, it's coming clear that some of the new strangeness is, in fact, old hat. Part of the spooky feeling is of history repeating itself. In Hillary Clinton, you can see, if you want to, the ghost of Democrats' past trapped between a youth uprising and the party machine. 40-plus years ago, she was part of the anti-war rebel alliance with George McGovern. Now, as historian Bruce Schulman, biographer of the 70s, points out, she looks more like Hubert Humphrey, 1968. He was overqualified for the nomination, but overburdened by the war in Vietnam.
We are very much living out the legacies of 1968 and 1972. And I think, interestingly, there's been this turnaround. In 1972, the young Hillary Clinton, and along with Bill, worked as the Texas state coordinators for the insurgent campaign of anti-war South Dakota Senator George McGovern. And McGovern was not only an opponent of the war, not only was he at the left of the Democratic Party at that time, but he was someone who wanted to open up the presidential selection process, open up the party to previously underrepresented groups, to youth, to insurgents, bring in a new open participatory style of politics. And the young Hillary Clinton was very much a part of that campaign. And what's so interesting is that a generation later, that's flipped, and Hillary Clinton has ceased to be the McGovern candidate and has become the Humphrey candidate.
I asked Bruce Schulman, is it in the stars that candidates have to go up to be their opposites?
Well, I don't know that they have to become. I mean, part of what we can attribute both the transformation of Humphrey and the transformation of Hillary has something to do with their earlier success. Hubert Humphrey did move the Democratic Party, which had been reluctant to endorse civil rights in the 1940s when he stood up and made his heroic speech at the 1948 convention. The Democratic Party did become the party of civil rights. It did get the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act through. And in the process, he became part of the establishment. Similarly, the insurgents in 1972 have become the establishment of the Democratic Party. So some of that is generational change. But I think also there's something in the way that the experience of actually governing or being close to governing for both Humphrey and Hillary Clinton has led them to a different theory about what you can accomplish in American politics and a skepticism about promises of visionary transformation of the kind that George McGovern and Eugene McCarthy made in 1968 and 1972, and that Bernie Sanders is making now. And if you think about what it is that Hillary is touting, there is an embrace of small-scale incremental change. Doesn't make her an appealing candidate, but maybe makes her an effective president. The burden is pretty heavy, and in some ways it's even heavier to bear now than it was for Hubert Humphrey. I mean, after all, not only has the process changed, but we've had a generation and a half of the success of what we call outsider campaigns in American politics. And Donald Trump, I think, represents the apotheosis of the outsider campaign, someone that not only has never held elective office, but was not a military leader either. And I don't think we've ever had a president of the United States who had no experience in public service before potentially entering the White House.
If somebody said, Hillary, the trick is to escape the fate of Hubert Humphrey, how would she do it?
In some ways, of course, we don't know how important it will be that she is the first, or she is soon to become the first female major party nominee for president of the United States, and that in her very being, she embodies something that is not part of the establishment, and that her gender identity might give her a certain kind of authenticity and appeal to history so that she can tap into some of that desire for visionary change that appeals to a broad swath of the American electorate, that she can escape, you know, the fate of Hubert Humphrey. But maybe she's going to fall, like Humphrey did, into the effectiveness trap. Humphrey was a visionary politician. He was the left-wing reform element of the Democratic Party. But the crafty, the wily Lyndon Johnson managed to pull him into cooperation with him, with the party's establishment, in order to get things done. He convinced Humphrey that in order to be effective, he had to compromise some of his principles, not go for the whole ball of wax all at once, but go for small incremental change. And of course, also convince Humphrey that he had to endorse the war in Vietnam and be loyal to Johnson's Vietnam policies. I think that's why we can say Hillary Clinton as senator decided to vote to authorize the war in Iraq, that she was afraid of getting too far out in front of the electorate at that time. And in her desire to maintain her effectiveness, she might have harmed herself as a candidate for president.
That was Bruce Schulman of Boston University. His big book is called The 70s, Nancy Rosenblum and Andrew Solomon. I listened to the interesting sort of discovery of the roots of old roots of today's malaise. And I'm just wondering, do we Americans have a sort of peculiar gap in between the sort of bursting, hopey, changey vision thing? Hopey changey is attributed to Obama, the vision thing to George H.W. Bush, between all of that stuff and the humdrum of democratic delivery. Nancy?
I think that there is an essential difference between movements, political and social movements, and party politics and governing. And if you look back at the period that you were just discussing, the late 60s and early 70s, this was an era of movements, of an anti-war movement, of civil rights, and then a black power movement, of Students for a Democratic Society, and not least a feminist movement. And translating movements and incorporating them into party politics and the business of government is always going to be difficult. It was difficult then, and to the extent that you think that we have movements now, that Bernie Sanders, for example, really does represent a democratic socialism that we haven't seen for a long time, but he's doing it essentially outside of a party structure, or his people and supporters are, that kind of melding is difficult, and it's always going to seem to people who are part of visionary movements compromising and complicitous, and they will always be discontented.
Andrew Solomon, what's our vision problem?
Well, I think that there's always an enormous question of whether you would rather vote for someone who represents your ideals perfectly or someone who is at least vaguely in the ballpark of your ideals but seems to be competent. I think the failures of the Arab Spring that we've all witnessed from some distance have shown that actually competence is a necessary precondition to anything happening. Now, I'm not going to get into the fine points of the debate, but Hillary Clinton is generally, I think, held forward as the most competent candidate. But competency is not very exciting, and giving stump speeches in which you essentially say, you know, you may not feel like I'm really representing your ideals, but I really will be able to get things done, even though it's accurate and even though it may be the most important promise that someone campaigning can make, isn't necessarily sufficient to get people out and to get them to show up at the polls. So Hillary has had the difficulty of being, I think, actually quite an idealistic woman. I mean, an idealistic but complicated woman, an idealistic woman with many dreams and ambitions, as actually all people who run for president of the United States have a lot of dreams and ambitions, but still with quite a lot of idealism. But I feel like what the Sanders campaign has done is to suggest that Bernie Sanders is the one who actually wants to fix the world, and Hillary Clinton is a technocrat. And I think that's been a short-selling of her, and I hope it's one she'll be able to turn around.
I think we feel differently about that, Andrew. I think Bernie was right to check her on her experience. More important than experience is judgment, and she's made some giant blunders, not to mention the Iraq vote, but even on her own. And I don't want to argue the point, but I would say one of the things that I find curious about this nation as a patient is a kind of uncritical amnesia. We forget things. There's not a lot of critical thinking about the recent past and real records, I would say, in this campaign. But let me mention another thing just as a symptom of the time that I think is absolutely fascinating, is in Mr. Trump, we have a kind of acceptable bully. We never liked bullies. He's the absolute villain from the schoolyard up. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, seemed to be abating. If you believe Steven Pinker and the better angels of our nation, we're getting over things like spanking or bullying or all kinds of even domestic nastiness. Suddenly, we're nuts about a bully in Donald Trump.
He's not just a bully. He's ignorant. And this goes back to the point you were all making about...
No, but again, I want to bring it back to us. What we... I don't want this is well, to trash any particular candidate, but what are we seeing about our own responses?
I will bring it back to us. You discussed the divide between ideals and competence and defended Bernie Sanders in saying that knowledge wasn't everything. Judgment counted, too. But we're now seeing a campaign in which knowledgeability is outright rejected. It is not seen as important, where Hillary Clinton has to argue that her knowledge and her competence matter in a president. This is really quite a unique situation, as somebody wrote, one of the great guardrails of our democracy and political parties has been broken down, which is an element of respect for knowledgeability, because what it demonstrates is not just competence in governing. It illustrates that you have had enough interest in the public interest to learn about how the world operates and how politics operates and what can be done and what can't. In other words, it's a kind of investment or insurance of some kind of devotion to the public good on the part of the person who's looking for your vote.
And I think that's very, very wise. And I think we also live in a moment of a crisis in admiration, that people used to grow up wanting to feel that the people who led them were people whom they looked up to. Mm-hmm. And people now want to feel that the people who lead them are people who are like them. And I think that's been a very, very troubling shift, that it's now seen as somehow undignified to look up to someone. And the assumption is that if someone can do all kinds of things that you can't do, that person is very suspect. I have quite a high opinion of myself, and I would like the president to be much smarter than I am and much more capable and much better connected and all kinds of other things.
Brother Solomon. It's not going to happen. Go back to your own life as a traveler, Andrew. From the all-time apex of G.I. Joe, when you we've lost some altitude, and I feel it abroad. What do you observe?
Oh, we've lost altitude enormously. I mean, friends from all over the world are writing to me saying, what is going on in your country? They're completely and utterly bewildered by it. I think bewildered by it in part insofar as it influences them. I mean, I saw a friend recently who was Italian who said to me, I feel like we should all get to vote in your election because it's going to have so much effect on me. So it's not just a matter of people kind of laughing about it in the way that people might have laughed, I don't know, at Berlusconi or at other people who were elected to lead European nations. It's a sense people have that this really could spell a major change in the world order and will destroy their lives as well as ours.
Who wants to grapple with the word nihilism? When you spoke of, you know, guardrails down, Nancy, and people not caring. When you think, you hear the contempt for public figures, I think eternally about those Trump folk just standing there screaming, Lion Ted, in the candidate's face. And he was no favorite of mine, but I mean, something's turned. How do we identify it?
Well, I wouldn't describe this as nihilism. I think there really is a hunger for a democracy that works for us.
And
one of the things that we're seeing with the Trump campaign and the Sanders campaign that are bringing out people who've never been in politics before is that there is this hunger, and it's attaching to a variety of things, not always good things, but that it's there. So I would not describe that as nihilism. I think it's the result of something else. I think it's the result of a decade now of a very different kind of democratic politics in this country. If you think back even to the periods of conflict that you've described, ordinary conflictual politics, the parties or politicians or partisans accuse one another of having bad policies or not understanding the public interest or having cynical motives, and they're certainly uncivil to one another. But what we've seen for a decade is what I think of as the delegitimization of the opposite side. And this goes to the heart of and degrades the heart of democracy, which is about partisan rivalries and agreeing to disagree and the notion of a legitimate opposition. And that has been eroded so that the opposition now not only has to be conquered, you know, you have to win office, you have to be victorious, but they have to be neutered, they have to be made impotent, they have to be criminalized, they have to be described as traitorous, their supporters have to be intimidated. And when you have a decade or so of that kind of politics, I think it trickles down and it affects people. And that's what we're seeing in this nasty primary that we've just been through.
And centrally, I think, as that process unfolds, we have also seen politicians moving away from keeping up even the appearance of being focused primarily on public service. So that the focus on winning and winning and winning again often upstages any question of whether, in certain instances, gracefully working out a compromise might in fact better serve the needs of the people. And when that happens, the democratic process is severely compromised, and I think that's a large chunk of why people now look at electoral politics as a kind of entertainment, because they don't think any of these people are particularly interested in really doing good in the world.
Nancy, I want to encourage your notion that hunger, vocally, you know, shouted out there, hunger for a better public democracy is a late sign of maybe returning health. There's got to be something good in that roar out there, and in our listening carefully, I think.
Well, there doesn't have to be something good in that roar out there. I mean, there may be. I don't see anything necessarily redemptive about it. I'm just saying that when people who have not voted or participated at all, who have not considered them citizens in any kind of engaged or institutional sense, come out, what you're seeing at least is a desire to, and the Tea Party people said this first, women walked around with placards that said, I want my democracy back.
Yep.
And that's what you're seeing here. Now, these people may be exploited, they may be wrongheaded, it may be ruinous that they're coming out, although I don't think so. I have a great, finally confidence in the democratic disposition.
So do I, Nancy. We're going to keep listening. I find it an unbelievably interesting year. Thank you, Nancy Rosenblum and Andrew Solomon. Thanks also to Bruce Schulman and Marilyn Robinson. Thanks to Den Epstein for his recording help. We are thrilled to be well into our 2016 fundraising drive. Please join our growing network of supporters at radioopensource.org/donate. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Phil Guerra. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.